Hey, it's Jill. Welcome back to BU Podcast. So on this show, we have primarily solo episodes, conversations between you and me and you, one-on-one. And then about 25% of the time, I get to have great conversations with people who I have handpicked. I'm really, really, really selective about who I put in front of you. And I always invite people who have either made a really big impact on my personal growth or someone who I think could do that for you. Sometimes it's someone I just stumble across online. It's always, though, someone that I intuitively know. I'm like, in my body, I can feel for sure that it's a full yes from me, even if I don't have any idea what we're going to talk about. So Kelly Gardner is one of those people. Never met him. Came across him through people we are mutually in contact with in the personal growth world, and heard nothing but wonderful things about him from some people I really, really respect. And it was right in alignment with what I felt in my body when I watched one of his reels on Instagram. I messaged him right away and said, "This is so freaking good. You are so good. There's just so much posing and self-anointing in the personal growth coaching world on social media. But there's also so much good stuff, so many talented, passionate, committed leaders, professionals, and coaches like Kelly Gardner." So Kelly and I sat down, it's been a few months ago that we talked, and we talked about a lot of things related to relationships. So the conversation you're about to hear goes in many directions, and it will help you learn more about yourself, about the human experience, about how we show up and why we do, and how you can use that to grow more loving relationships with everyone in your life. So let me tell you about Kelly Gardner. With over 25 years of experience in education, Kelly has taught some form of personal growth to individuals from preschool to graduate school and beyond. His early training in drama therapy, nonviolent communication, which by the way is something we explain in today's conversation, and childhood development, combined with his more recent experiences in parenting, personal development, and leadership training to create a unique approach to helping individuals grow their most loving relationships. So get comfy, open your heart, open your mind, and be ready to be blown away and blessed by a chat with Kelly Gardner.
There is nothing more inspiring than a woman being unapologetically herself.
The answers are all in your heart.
She's waiting.
She's waiting.
She's waiting for you to set her free.
Welcome to BU Podcast. I'm Jill Herman, and I am so glad you're here. I was broke, insecure, and craved approval. But with grit, hustle, and sacrifice, I still built a successful multi-million dollar business. 10 years in, burnout, I slowed down and looked inward. In that silence, I discovered that the same level of success could have come to me with much less effort and so much more joy. That's when I threw out the expectations of the world and chose to unbecome every single thing I thought I was supposed to be. And the real me was uncaged. It was far from easy. And in this podcast, I'll offer my entire journey as a roadmap so that if you're ready, you can finally be you. Hey, Kelly, we are finally sitting down together after chatting about this for quite some time. Welcome to BU.
Oh, thank you, Jill. It is such a pleasure to get to be on with you and to deepen the conversations that we've had so far. It's great to see you in person.
Yes, and I want to thank you publicly. I've thanked you privately, but thank you for, you did not know me at all. And I reached out I saw a reel that someone had shared of yours. And I reached out to you. I shared it and then I reached out and I think I said, okay, this is so good. Like it was so, so, so good. And then we just chatted back and forth. And then I shared something really personal with you that was going on in my family. And you supported me back and forth for quite some time having no idea if I would ever use your services, hire you, or that you'd get anything out of it. And then you even checked back later, and it really meant a lot to me. And I want to thank you again for that.
No, it really is an honor. And I do mean that. And I say that, you know, each and every one of us, we receive gifts through the challenges that we face in life. And getting to use those gifts for the opportunity to grow myself and others is just such an honor that I get to have this time in life to learn from all of my previous mistakes, all of my challenges, and offer them up. And so I just continue to look and see, where is the world looking for what it is that I've learned through the challenges that I've faced?
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. All right. So let's start with this. I don't tend to ask people about their background or where they got to where they are. I like to just dive into whatever we want to chat about. But I do feel called to ask you, tell us about Kelly Gardner. That's a big question, I know. But tell us who you are. What brought you to this place now where you're coaching and mentoring people? And I know you have a really interesting story.
Well, thank you. You know, I think one of the most foundational experiences of myself was really just being born into this world as a biracial man. And in the 1970s, where my parents were arrested for cohabitating, and realizing that I lived between two very different worlds. And as an early child, I had to figure out how to navigate these very different realities and somehow put them together in a way that made sense. And I think that really moved so much of my work. And early in my 20s, I got involved in theater for social change and a theater company in Washington, D.C., where we did improvisation, working with pretty much any community that we could, any community that did not have access to their own artistry. What we would do is we would come in and we'd create improvisational theater pieces around the experiences that they were having in their lives, and then bring them to a heightened moment where they got to step in and play out a new reality. And really in that, I got to learn a lot about what was then called nonviolent communication, which I now refer to as compassionate communication, but realizing all of the different ways that we could act in each and every moment. What if we had the opportunity to try those on? And that sprung me into a long journey into working with young people, working with adults, working with pretty much every kind of community that, again, did not have access to expressing themselves. And how could we use art and artistry as a tool for learning how to express the challenges that I'm facing and move into a life where life is not happening to me, but it is happening for me. All of these things that have happened in my experience are actually just the opportunities to build the version of life that I'm supposed to offer, that I don't like to say I'm supposed to, but that I am here to really live into. And that really became the foundation for a journey into education, teaching. I was the dean of a film school for a long time and eventually came back to men's work, where I was in a process of my own marriage unfolding and learning a lot about how much I had been separating myself in my relationships and separating myself from the people that could see me, that could care for me, and creating toxic relationships in this singular relationship with my partner, with a child, and learning how to open up my life to be seen in a way that I'd never been seen. So that took me on a long journey of running men's groups and supporting men to create a place where they could be vulnerable, to be honest about what was going on in their lives. And the main thing that I continued to see in that space was the challenges that men faced with being in relationship, and particularly long-term relationship, and how to be authentically themselves, to not hide from who they were being, and to learn primarily to ask for what they wanted and what they needed in a world where they believed that those needs would be met. And so over the last 30 plus years, I've had a really varied career and life in really working in multiple places of communication. And how do we get to communicate on a deep level that at the end of the day gets all needs met.
So much I want to ask about. Okay, so if you'll just let me lead for a minute, I want to go back to what you did with the groups of people who were, you were using artistry, you said. And so my question is, were you using artistry because that was what you were familiar with? Or were you using artistry because you knew that it would like disarm them? Because otherwise it would feel like therapy to them, or a little bit of both maybe.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. The theater company that I worked with was really at the cutting edge. It started in 1968 and was what we call proto-drama therapy, came before drama therapy. And so many ways you might say that we were doing drama therapy.
Are you saying drama with a D? Drama therapy?
Yeah, drama.
I've
drama
never heard of that. Never heard of that.
Yeah, yeah, drama therapy. So it's not uncommon, like role play, you know, where you would go in and you would act out the situation from the perspective of, let's say, the other person and get to see and experience what they were experiencing. And so it part of it was early therapeutic approach, but really what it was, the belief underneath it was that every single person has the need to create. There's a sign up on the wall that said it. Every person has the need to create, to transform the viciousness and mediocrity of life into sunshine and hope. Welcome to this place where you can dare to be free, dare to dream, dare to be yourself. All power to the imagination. And so it was the idea that each and every one of us wants to create. We want to play. We want to express our full self. So we created a theater space where you could play and express your full self. And what we found is that when people come into an improvisation and they're untrained actors, they go directly to their own experiences.
Yes.
And we find in play that they're just expressing their authentic truth. And then they get to be witnessed in that truth. And the power of witnessing is tremendous, because we all want to just say what's really alive for us and be seen and not be judged and know that I'm still here. I mean, just think about all those things that you're holding on to, you know, all of those fears that you're afraid of somebody finding out. What if you just walked around with that on your forehead and everyone already knew exactly all of those things and then they accepted you? What life would I get to live if I just got to be who I was, say all of my scariest things, and everyone would just say, oh, well, that's Jill. That's Kelly. That's just who they are. And I accept you and I love you. And that was really the foundation of why we use theater, to act on those most essential parts of ourselves that just want to play, express, and create.
Yeah. And when you said, you saw me on camera light up, when you said that if they weren't trained actors, they would go to their own experience. Of course they did. I would have never thought of that though. Of course, because you have nothing else to draw on, right? But your own experience. And then I could see that it probably starts coming up and out, and then that unlocks other things, and then it locks more, and then they get more free. And then they have all these discoveries about themselves that I would imagine it's not just, oh, I wish I could express this, but I can't. I would imagine there are times where they go, what the hell did I just say? I can't believe I just did that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I remember doing this program with teenagers. We were talking about, we were having them play out some concepts as parents. And so one parent, one teenager would play the parent. And I always remember this one where this friend, a boy and a girl, were having this improvisation. And, you know, the guy was trying to get something from his mother, and he was communicating to his mother, and you know, he's just stopped cold in his tracks, and he says, I love you, you know. And she just looks at him, she's like, I don't know what to do with that, you know. And like, you could see her just melt, like every essence of like her teenagerness just kind of dropped apart, and she was just like, God, I so wanted to hear that.
Yeah.
But you know, that tapped into something that was so true for her as well. You know, in these points of play, we really get to tap into truth. I think that's what's so great about movies. That's why we go to them. It's not because they're make-believe. It's because of the deep truth that's under the story. And when I see it, I feel it, and I know that that speaks to something about my own experience. And that's what I really love about drama and the exploration of acting and portraying a character.
So did not expect us to talk about that. And I'm so glad we did. It's so interesting. When you said that we watch a movie, not because it's like, you know, entertaining and make-believe, but it's because of the truth. I've never thought about that before. Of course, that hits. That's right. I've shared this on my show before. I'm going to say it again. And I'm going to tell you that I was watching the Elton John movie with my husband whenever that came out a few years ago. And I wasn't consciously struggling with what I'm going to share with you in a second at all. It was just somewhere back there in my head. And we're watching it. And when he decided to really say, okay, I am gay, like this is me, this is who I am, like you could just feel it, right? Just him finally setting himself free. All of a sudden, tears welled up in my eyes and I became so emotional. And I turned and I looked at my husband and just out of my mouth, these words just fell out. And I said, I have to quit my job. And he looked at me and he's like, wait, what'd you just say? And I was like, I'm not kidding. I can't do it anymore. I'm done. And that was when I made the decision because I identified with that truth of being who you are and just finally just saying, I can't live this way anymore. And that's an example of what you just were speaking of.
Yeah, you know, I do this program and I do it every year around setting our goals, but we start with values. And the best way that I can communicate our core values is if you think about a movie that really moved you, maybe even moved you to tears, what was moving you was the core value that it was affirming. So it's not the information that was transmitted through what Elton John said when he was gay. It was the core value of being honest with his truth.
Oh, right? Sure.
And that core value resonates. And so when I watch a movie and something is moved within me, it's striking a chord of a core value that I know is essential to who I am. And when I see that and I feel it, like there's each and every one of us has a note inside of us, and it just plucks on this right note and something just vibrates through my whole system. And I'm like, ooh, that's my core value.
Mm.
I really align with that one, you know, and that's what I hear when I hear you say that it just struck you and everything in your body moved and you were like, yes, I have to do something about this. That is a core value of mine. I have to speak my truth. I have to live in my truth. That is who I am and that's who I'm here to be. And that's just my note inside of my body.
Yeah. And I had been saying for about a year and a half, everything on paper tells me to stay at this career. It checks all the boxes, but it's not me anymore. And I had all the unhealthy reasons for staying. And yeah, when I saw him in that scene, and I really did after that, I was done. Really interesting. Really interesting. Okay. So I would like to know before you got to the point where you're helping other men, what would you be willing to share with us? What did you discover about yourself in that work? Before you were working with anyone else, clearly you did a lot of work in and on yourself. You said you had toxic relationships, you had a marriage unfolding, you were a father. You know, what did you discover about Kelly that then allowed you to get to a point where then you could hold other men walking through that?
Yeah, thank you. You know, it's interesting. I started really early I was 19 years old when I started working in personal development. I'm turning 47 this year. So I got involved really early in this world. And at the same time, I thought I knew a lot that I didn't really know. You know, I've been teaching compassionate communication and working with youth for over a decade when I had my first marriage and my first son was born. And I thought because I taught compassionate communication, I get this. I know how to communicate. Fast forward to a screaming toddler and a screaming dad who's yelling at his toddler and yelling at his wife and, you know, finding himself in perhaps one of the most difficult relationships definitely the most difficult relationship I'd ever been in my life. I think the flip side of that is my ex-wife was just here visiting our 16-year-old and staying with us for the weekend with her newborn. She's like my older sister now today. But what I discovered was that being able to know or be aware of these things did not give me a mastery of it. And what I had to do is go through the dark night of the soul and really see the most difficult patterns in my life. And some of those patterns that I would share is, one is, I always considered myself a giver, somebody who looked out for other people. What I really discovered was what I had been doing was manipulating relationships by giving to other people without ever asking for anything in return, but ultimately wanting something in return. And so I was that classic guy who would go into relationship and I would figure you out. I would see all of your faults. You would tell me all of your darkest secrets. You would tell me everything, and I would be the safe guy. But what I was really doing was creating a space where I was needed. You always needed me, and I always gave you a little bit more than you gave to me because I never asked for anything in return. So what appeared to be the nice guy on the outside who was looking out for you, who was a safe place for you to share your darkest secrets and hold you in the times of difficult, would then spin those things against you. And I would become a tyrant who, instead of asking for what I want, I would use the fact that I'd already given you so much to manipulate situations, to be angry and abusive, to tell myself that it was okay for me to act out because I'd already given you so much. But really what I was doing is creating the role of the caretaker. And I distinguish between a caretaker and a caregiver. Someone who gives care is giving it freely. They are seeking to bring more into the world. But the caretaker is afraid that they will be abandoned. They're afraid that they'll be left behind. And so I create a role where my care is honestly taking away from you because you will never have freedom away from me. I create a codependent relationship where you need me. And so a lot of my life in my 30s was really learning to change that dynamic, learn how to ask for help, to learn to identify where I was manipulating situations as the nice guy, but ultimately hurting people in the process. And I'd say that that was perhaps one of the biggest gifts, you know, of always thinking I was the guy that had it figured out. And when life fell apart, I realized that ultimately I was scared of abandonment. My father had left when I was young. The only woman that I'd loved deeply had left me as well. And so I created these patterns where I just could not be left, and I could be abusive emotionally to anybody who was thinking about leaving me because there was no place for them outside of my relationship.
Gosh, thank you for all that. I know there are people hearing that who, it's a lot to hear someone share something about themselves that sounds so like dark, or I know, and you know, that that's the most beautiful part of healing is that you can openly share that and you have no judgment towards yourself for that because you know that's not your highest self anyway, right? And so, as you said, you walk around almost with that written on your forehead, just saying, hey, this is just who I am, you know, and that's how you're living. So thank you for sharing all of that. And I know that that's an invitation to some people listening to just, I guess I would say this, I shouldn't say I know, I would invite anyone listening after hearing that to like even just pause right now and just take that in and ask themselves, you know, what are some parts of themselves that are showing up that look really good and look altruistic when they're still not bad and wrong, but they're really not what they appear. And I think I would assume you would agree that the gift in doing that is that they're going to find out things about themselves that will, I mean, just change the complete direction of their life and every relationship forward if they would just look at that and just ask that question, but without which is hard, right? Without judging yourself and shaming yourself and saying, oh my God, I'm such a piece of shit. I can't believe I've done all this. Do you have something to say about that?
Well, yeah, you know, I'd say that in addition to that, it's recognizing that when my relationships are falling apart, or when they seem like they've hit a dead end, that's actually the place where I get the most opportunity for growth. And so I would add to that, if, you know, if I'm sitting in this place of going, God, how did I get myself in this position again? You know, how did I invite this person? Oh my God, I see that guy. I've been with that guy before. Well, then I ask myself, what is it about me that's continuing to choose that? And how is this also a gift from the divine showing me direction to what it is that I'm getting to look at? Because I do believe that every person that comes into my life is bringing a gift. And it's just, I used to have a mantra that everything in life is already perfect. It's just up to me to see the perfection in it.
I love that.
So how is this situation, how is this wrong action, this place that I stumbled, how is this also just showing up for me?
You going from a place of thinking that you're living one way to realizing it actually was codependency, manipulation, control, et cetera. Oh, and by the way, that's also connected to my abandonment issues. I mean, was that years of work? Was that, because you know, you can have an awakening in a very short amount of time. Did you keep bumping up against that for a long time?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. There's the long, slow path of just stumbling over it and doing it all by myself. And then there's the accelerated path of doing it with help. And I would say that I took the long and slow path for most of that time. You know, each time I'd fall over, I'd pick myself up and say, oh, I figured that one out. And then I'd fall over the next one and, you know, pick myself back up. And it really wasn't until I discovered men's work that I started to really accelerate that work. So I would say that a lot of it, I did it over about a decade of time, the hard way. For me, I went through a really difficult divorce and looked at all the things that I had done and thought, well, I'm going to do the exact opposite. And so I did the other version of this, which is I rubber banded. So I was in a relationship with someone who was very competitive. We were in graduate school at the same time. She was at Caltech. I was at Cal Arts. You know, we were merging the arts and the science, and we were both high achievers, but we really didn't have a lot in common, and we were constantly in competition. And so as I healed from that, I thought, well, I need someone who's completely different, because I was still pointing the finger at the other person. You know, even though I thought I was healing, I was still playing a victim. I was still pointing the finger at the other person. And so I went and chose somebody who was the exact opposite in many ways. We were on a yoga retreat and, you know, someone just full of heart and spirit. And, you know, we would never be in competition. And then I spent the rest of that marriage discovering how I wanted her to be in competition with me. but I had chosen somebody that never could. And so I did the rubber band, right? I chose the exact opposite.
Okay. I didn't know what you meant when you said that, when you rubber banded. Okay. Got it.
Yeah. Yeah. I just bounced right back in the opposite direction and chose someone that was the exact opposite in many ways. And then I had to learn that I was still just pointing the finger at somebody else. And it wasn't until I was, you know, about 4 or 5 years into that marriage that I started my journey into men's work and started to hold myself with other people that could reflect back different versions of myself. And that's when the intensity of my healing work started, and when I started really leaning into getting coaches and getting support. I met some of our shared friends in that space. And that's when I really started to accelerate the work. But most of the time, I'd say I was kind of seeing the problems, pointing at somebody else who created the problem, and then running in the opposite direction only to find another problem waiting for me around the corner.
Yeah, it's like that. What's that saying? Wherever you go, there you are. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, it's a great example of that. So let's talk about the idea of men's work. I would guess, as a female, so I am guessing, but I have brothers, I have a dad, I have a husband, I have sons, but I'm still guessing. I would guess that similar to women, just being witnessed and being in community is huge. And I would guess that it's even more so with men, because it's not something that happens very often now in these current times, right? Tribal year is different, but is that correct? That men just don't get in close community often enough and they don't show their cards at all, let alone in front of other men. Is that right?
Yeah, I'd say that's true. And my experience is that women coming together and being vulnerable is on some level a part of what is built into our understanding of society. You know, having sisters and sharing, you know, like, oh, this is what's coming up for me. That's a very normal part of our social structure. Men are socialized in a world where that isn't a normal part of our lives. The closest we ever had to that was being on a team when we were younger. And maybe if we stayed on a team when we were older, we may have a spiritual life. I may go to church and have relationships in that way and build connections. But for the most part, masculine relationships are built around what I can do and what I can do for you. And so, you know, I had a good friend who once said, you know, men don't really come together unless we have something to do. You know, unless we're building
Great
something,
point.
Creating
yeah.
something, or
playing a game.
Yeah, or playing a game, you know, then we don't really come together. And as a result, we tend to live very isolated lives. Most men, you know, have a community when they're teenagers, you know, they will, and then they'll go off to college and they'll have another community of guys that they hang out with. But a large part of that community is around dating. You know, I go out with my guys so I can meet some girls. And then what happens is I meet a girl and, you know, we start having a relationship. And, you know, if that relationship goes good, then we enter into this new stage where it's not that comfortable to hang out with my single friends. So I start hanging out with my friends who are in relationship. And oftentimes those relationships are built around my female partner. They're the ones that actually create the social structure. And I just show up and I hang out with the other guys.
Very
and
then true.
We have, right?
Sorry, I'm just laughing. So I'm thinking even I'm 5 years older than you. It's like, yeah, uh-huh, still like our friends are my friends that I've created
exactly.
for us.
Yeah, exactly. And so we just kind of go along to get along. We hang out with the people and then our kids go off to school and now we're hanging out with the other parents, you know, and my single friends are long, long gone. And so now I'm surrounded by a group of people that I have to put on a certain face for, you know, these are parents of my kids' friends, you know, and so, you know, I'm putting on a certain face, I'm showing up in social spaces, but I don't really have a community of people that I feel like I can be honest and truthful with. I mean, one, it's probably going to get back to my wife anyways, you know, and whatever I say, you know. And so I've lost that sense of community that I can be honest and truthful with. And the reality is the people that I was honest and truthful with, we never developed skills on how to be honest and truthful as adults. And so, you know, you look at the numbers of depression, of anxiety, suicide, the rates for men are through the roof. And there's something behind that. And I really do think that that's about our lack of deep connection, our lack of ability to be seen and witnessed in all of us. You know, I have a local group here that I host just to create community. And we start out by sharing what I don't want you to know about me. And it's so powerful for men to just have a space where they can say, hey, this is what I don't want people to know about me. And now we've created a community where, like I said, that's right on my forehead. And I'm not judging this guy on how big his car is or, you know, how big his house is or what he's doing. He's just another person. Just like I'm another person. And in that place, I get to really be myself and ask for help and ask for support in a way that is not someone reaching out to give me a handout, but just reaching out to do what they most authentically want to do which is to be there for somebody else who's going through something else that they've gone through as well.
Mm-hmm. And I would imagine that men even also just want to be seen and witnessed so they know that it's not just them, even if someone can't do anything for them about that, but just say, you are not alone. It's not just you. I feel the exact same way. So I have two older brothers and I'm the only girl, primarily raised by my dad. It's a long story, but very close with my dad. And then I have two boys and a husband. And I see this as I'm just picturing my dad, my brothers, my husband, my boys, my husband's dad. But it's everything you're saying. It's different generations, and it's all the same story that men not only hardly ever get together to have those kind of conversations, but it's like seeing that it's weak. It's weak to have that conversation. It's weak to even admit that you'd even want to have the conversation. Is it weak to even admit that you'd even be interested in a men's group like that? Well, who's going to be there? What? I mean, I'm not even a guy and I get it, what you're saying. And with women, I mean, we have our own stuff, obviously. And it is more natural. I just hosted my first women's circle. I mean, I've been hosting events for a long time, but this was a very intimate group of women in my home, very different from anything I did when I had a business in the past. And yes, there were a few women where it was really hard for them to open up. I mean, you know, type A, very successful, et cetera, et cetera. But it didn't take long because, as you said, it's more accepted and it is more natural for us. Like, that's how we connected. But I would imagine that for men, it's a completely different ballgame.
Yeah. You know, I think that one of the primary pieces is that I grew up in a society that taught me one of my primary responsibilities as a man was to create safety, that it's my responsibility to make everyone feel safe in my presence. Whether that meant, you know, physically or emotionally, I had to have it together in order for everyone else to feel safe in my proximity. And as a father, you know, as someone who's run businesses, who's been in a high level in organizations, it was my responsibility to have it together so that everybody else could feel safe. That's what leadership was taught to me early on. And so in that space, if I am to show up and say, you know, honey, I don't know that I can do this anymore. I don't know that I can hold this together. Then what starts to happen, well, what men carry is this fear that they will be discarded. Because if you can't create safety, if you can't hold it down, if you can't be the responsible one, then what value do you really have? And so it's, you know, particularly difficult for us to be vulnerable in that way because our vulnerability is a signal that we don't have value.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And also providing, you know, I look at my sons and I'm like, there's a lot of pressure on them that when they step into adulthood, manhood, they're expected to provide. Like, what does that even mean? Like, that's a lot of pressure on a young man, on any man. And it's connected to the safety part. And it's just so ironic, isn't it, that most men are adult little boys who don't feel safe at all.
And that is the key piece of it, is that we have not created in our modern society a system for boys to become men. You know, all the systems that currently exist are really creating toxic versions of masculinity. When we talk about that idea of toxic masculinity, I think that men are the ones that suffer from that idea, because the toxic masculine is, I can't express my emotions. Don't cry, boy, get up. You know, all of those notions of what it's supposed to be. When I don't have a place to express my authentic self, my feelings, my emotions, my fears, my anxieties, then that goes into the darkness. And in that darkness, it grows and it builds. And when it comes out, it's far scarier than it ever was in the first place. And so when we look at, you know, these male predators, or what we refer to as externally as the toxic men, hurt people, hurt people. Those are men who have had no belief in their ability to express their selves authentically. And so they've bottled it up and they've put a big old cork on it, and it just keeps growing and growing. And when it pops out, it is incredibly toxic to everyone that's around them. But they didn't create that.
Yes. I'm so glad we're talking about this. Like, you, I see all over social media, you know, toxic masculinity. And I'm not someone who really, you know, gets into the weeds with all that, but I know what they mean by it. And I thought to myself when I first saw that, it's not masculinity that's toxic. It just happens to be witnessing men behave in toxic ways, and you're not willing to look to see what the root cause of it is.
Yeah. Yeah, that it's a toxic form of masculinity, just like there's toxic forms of femininity. You know, there are incredibly toxic ways of masculinity is not the toxic thing. Masculinity is what we need. We need authentic masculinity in this world from both men and women. We need authentic masculinity, which holds a sense of responsibility, of ownership, of direction. But that's not just a man's job. That's all of our jobs. You know, when I talk about the energy of masculine and feminine, the in the yogic world, we call it the Shiva and the Shakti, the polarity of life itself, and that exists in all of us. And we have created in Western society this version of this idealized version of masculinity and femininity that is toxic to us all. It doesn't bring out the best version of me. It requires me to put on a mask and parade around as some version of me that's just a tiny fraction of who I am. And to get success, you know, I think about like the Andrew Tates. You know, Andrew Tate was probably a fat kid growing up. You know, and I'm not fat shaming anyone here, but really like the externalized version of masculinity that he presents is a reflection of someone who really has a deep-seated hatred of themselves. And so he's projecting out a version of himself that in, as it, just as I said, is a bottled up form that is exploding out in a way that is not helpful or beneficial to us all.
Yeah. And you're not excusing that behavior. And I know you're not asking women like my daughters to accept that behavior. What I hear you saying is, let's just call it what it is, though, and not just, you know, for lack of a better saying, throw the baby out with the bathwater and say, these toxic masculine men. You know, I think it's used a lot, just like the word narcissist. I mean, yeah. Especially really young women like my daughter's ages, like everybody's a narcissist. I'm like, I'm pretty sure he's not a narcissist. He ghosted you. He's a narcissist.
Yeah. I love that one too. It's, you know, everyone's throwing out that term narcissist these days. And, you know, if we get away from the diagnosis, sure, there are tendencies and we all have these tendencies. We all have these tendencies, but the notion that I have to diagnose somebody and point a finger at them just creates a villain. And I think as a society, we are addicted to this villain. Now, going back to my days of storytelling, one of the most powerful things that I learned was that the antagonist is really just the externalized version of the protagonist. In other words, the challenge that the individual, the protagonist, our hero in the story, if you will, is facing is himself, herself. And the antagonist is just an externalized version of that internal struggle that they're facing. But because we have drama, we want to see it as somebody outside of us.
Yes.
And it's just a metaphor, but we somehow started reading it literally. Like that villain,
yes, so
out there over there is the person that I have to be, you know, attacking. But whenever this thing comes up, whenever I'm going, oh, that person's a narcissist, really what they're reflecting is an internalized version of myself.
Yes.
That I don't want to look at.
Yes. A minute ago when you were talking, what came to me was this visual of when you were saying we're pointing the finger outward. And I was thinking to myself, it's interesting. It's like I'm pointing the finger out at you and calling you a narcissist or a toxic male, whatever. And if I just do what you're saying and point the finger at me, but actually look at me, here's what I just thought of. When I open my eyes after looking at me and spending time on that, you're either gone because you're never really what I thought you were, or you're gone because I never attracted you to begin with.
Exactly. Because the question is why am I bringing people into my space that have this quality? What is it about me that desires to have them in my space in the first place? What am I trying to fill? What am I trying to, what need is not being met in my life? So it is, it's pointing out there either because I'm seeing a reflection of myself that I don't want to look at, or I'm drawing something towards me that is filling a need that I also don't want to look at.
Mm-hmm. And that's why I'm such an advocate. I mean, this show is about 75% solo episodes. And the rest of the time I talk to people like you, who are, I bring you on so that people can see, look, not only do I not recommend doing this work alone, you don't have to do it alone. This is someone who could help you. This is another person who could help you. Don't tell me you don't have the resources. I'm bringing them to you because what we're talking about, someone listening might hear that and go, okay, I'm willing to look at myself. But you and I both know you can only look so deep by yourself. You can only see so much through your own ego, right? And so asking the question of, why am I attracting this? You know, why does this person keep showing up? Goes so far. But then the question of working with a coach or being in doing men's group like you lead, to me, the deeper question is, let's go back. Like, let's go way back. Let's go back where you don't want to go. And you don't even maybe remember it. But I'm telling you, there's a little boy inside of you from a long, long time ago that has some things he needs to say and he wants to say. And if we let him say those things and we hold space for him and we witness him and we love him, I am telling you right now, it's all going to make sense. And you won't need it to make sense anyway, because you won't be acting that way anymore. You won't be attracting these people. You won't be projecting it. Like, you and I have experienced that. I've experienced it. And I see my adult children. I'm so glad we've introduced them to this work young. 19, that's amazing. You started doing this inner work. I discovered, I wouldn't even say really inner work. I would say self-reflection and personal development, in air quotes, lots of mindset stuff, lots of affirmations, Tony Robbins stuff. It's all good. But I was 36, Kelly. 36 years old was the first time I had even heard of it. I didn't even know it existed. And then after doing that and going to the courses and the seminars and reading the books and all the stuff, I didn't even know, I had never heard of the word coach, did not know coaches existed outside of sports and athletics, did not know that this deeper work, the somatic work, the body work, all of that, I didn't know it existed until I was 49 years old. 49. And so that's one reason I have this podcast, to get this out to people. Hopefully someone's driving in their car and they're like, you know what? I'm 10 years ahead of her, you know, or I'm 2 days ahead of her. Anyway, what would you say is, in doing the work you do now, in leading this men's work, what is maybe either a story or an example of something that was the most profound or one of the most beautiful experiences of witnessing a man, you know, really let himself be seen and be free, and then maybe how that showed up in his life outside of that.
Wow, so many men, so many stories. That's a really good question. You know, I'm going to come back to probably the most recent man that just popped into my brain. I was working with a man recently who was the victim of sexual assault early in his life and had created a lot of different masks to keep everyone at bay. And one of the biggest masks that he wore was his physical fitness. He's a real big guy, jack guy, played football, you know, and he'd created this persona. When I first started working out, I used to say that I didn't want to build a big chest because those muscles were just there to push people away, right? If you think about the bench press, you're really just pushing people away. And as you push more people away, you create a shield over your heart. And you can see these guys that have these giant shields.
We got to pause. I've said that about the guys. Anytime a guy has like biceps the size of softballs, I'm a little snarky when I say it to my husband. I'm like, I wonder what his issues are. I've never thought ever about the bench press and physically pushing away. And then it builds that I'll call it like a cage, like around your heart. Wow.
No, I'm not telling anybody you can't have a nice big chest and everything. But, you know, as an adolescent, when that is the thing that is put in my brain, that is the idealized version of masculinity, is someone that can push people away and have this cage that protects their heart, I think there's something problematic about that. Particularly when I'm looking at a man who has experienced abuse, who was abused by, and this was within his religious world, you know, so going to the person that he trusted the most and was abused in that space. And so one, his parents, you know, didn't believe him early on, or, you know, he was told that this was a safe place that you could go. And so he had built up a, you know, not only a distrust for this man, an individual who's supposed to be a community leader, but also that his parents wouldn't be able to protect him, and built up all of these walls around him. We had him in a group not long ago, and you know, he's sharing all of this and literally sobbing and experiencing how much he had been holding by himself his entire life. And we just allowed him to fall into our arms. We had the entire room come together and lift him up and experience really being physically held. And you could feel him, you know, in the trauma work, you can feel him convulsing, literally shaking that energy out of his body. And for the first time, you know, having to trust a room full of men to hold him, to not drop him, and to really relax and let himself go into that space. You know, I shed so many tears of joy when I get to see men who have carried so much in their lives and finally just for that one moment just let go, you know. And I know your listeners, particularly the women out there, have seen and experienced that maybe once or twice or maybe quite a few times. But when you see a man who has everything figured out and you see him just let it all go, there's something so profound about that letting go that takes place. And so leaving that workshop, he ended up having reconciliation with his parents. He ended up actually bringing that to trial and had an entire process where they had a mediation. And he got to sit in front of the man who had molested him as a child. And I think one of the most powerful things that I heard from him in that process was that in that space, he got to own his power again. He developed the communication skills to not yell at the man, but to just honestly look him in the eyes and say, this is what I've lost. This is what it's meant to me. This is what it's meant to the people who have been around me. And I know that's an extreme example, but you know, at its heart, that's really what gets to take place. I get to reclaim the little boy who built up all of these protectors so as to not be hurt. And once I reclaim that little boy who's been protecting me my entire life, then I get to step into being the man who honors his limitations, who honors his humanness, and gets to show up and just say, hey, this is who I am. You can look at me, you can look me in the eyes, see my humanity, and I can see yours.
Mm-hmm. Isn't it beautiful that it was the act of him softening that allowed him to sit in that courtroom and face that person and not power and strength and everything he had been trying, you know, by lifting those weights and building all that muscle? It was the opposite of that.
Yeah, you know, it's so interesting to me how, you know, the very same thing that brought me my greatest successes in life is very often the same thing that's holding me back from the life that I say that I want.
Okay, go into that. Say that again.
Yeah. So thinking, you know, the things that have brought me the greatest successes in my life are oftentimes the very same thing that is holding me back from the life that I say that I want. So that little boy who, you know, was scared and afraid built a, you know, a strong facade and exterior, who got to be accepted in football and became part of a team and got to, you know, to push everyone away. And then as he grew up and he got into relationships, his relationships began to fall apart. He found himself becoming isolated and abandoned, just, you know, in the same way, because that same facade that had created acceptance became the same thing that was pushing people away from the deeper connections that he's wanting. And so this almost always shows up in relationships. You know, I think I'm great. I think everything's going really wonderful. For men, I know my experience is, you know, I built this great kingdom and I've got no one to share it with. So I'm going to get into relationship and then I'll be able to share all of my greatness with this other person. And then I get into relationship and I realize I'm not that great. I got all this shit and she sees it and she knows it and she's pointing it out and oh, I'm mad at her for pointing it all out. And then the relationship starts to fall apart and we have all these other problems instead of realizing that this relationship is the gift. It is showing me all of these parts that get to evolve. The kid gets to become a man through these dynamics, through the relationships with others, because those are the mirrors that reflect back my true essence.
Oh, for sure. Yes. Okay, so I would like to take a little bit of a left turn, still on the same path, but just a little bit of a left turn and circle back to nonviolent communication. Okay, I have never liked the term nonviolent communication, and I had no idea people were calling it something else. I can't stand the name. It evokes just an image that I don't like. And it's so interesting because that actually got in the way when I was supposed to be learning nonviolent communication in some studies I did. I was like, yeah, not interested because I didn't like the name of it. Of course, I get it and I think it's wonderful. But if I'm going to be really transparent, that is the one area of my marriage where it would be the biggest gift to our relationship. And we have grown so much. And I've shared much that you haven't heard on this podcast about our second marriage. And we hired Steph, who you know, as our one-on-one coach and worked with Christine. And then we've done a lot. And we have built the most amazing and rebuilt the most amazing relationship and done a lot of internal work individually, et cetera, et cetera. And that's the one thing that I don't even know if they realize we never really implemented. I mean, I knew what it was and I explained it to TK, my husband, and then Steph brought it up once and kind of assumed we were using it and I didn't tell him we weren't and TK didn't tell him that we weren't. Will you explain, what do you call it again? What is your name for it?
I refer to it as compassionate communication.
Okay. So what is compassionate communication? And I'm going to sit here as a student because I do not practice it. What I do is I pretend I practice it. I put my pinky toe in and I will listen and I reflect back some of what they say. Right? So I do better than I've done before, but it's not easy for me.
Yeah. So the term nonviolent communication comes from Marshall Rosenberg. He was the founder of that idea. And I would argue it wasn't very good marketing. And, you know, there's a lot of people that have very similar ideas to you about just the frame, you know, nonviolent. Well, who's saying that my communication is violent, you know? And what's underneath that is he had a concept that when communication breaks down, violence is inevitable. When communication breaks down, violence is inevitable. So how do I create communication that will not lead to violence? How do I stay in the conversation? I think that was what was underneath it in the idea of nonviolence. And, you know, I think it was early in the 60s, and so had better marketing at the time. Compassionate communication is, he also said that he wants everyone to use this, but unless it's nonviolent communication is trademarked. And so I'm not a Marshall Rosenberg teacher, and so I don't use nonviolent communication. And it's convenient because I don't like the term either. You know, I taught it for a very long time, and I used it in teen programs. I ran a nonprofit for teenagers called City at Peace in Los Angeles in my 20s, bringing together teenagers from cross-cultural parts of Los Angeles and creating a unified theater piece based on their life experiences. And we would do improvisation to kind of unearth all of the power dynamics that they were experiencing and what those looked like. And interweave into that how to communicate more effectively. And when I learned it, as most people learn it, it's a process language. And a process language means if I use these words, then on the other side, there will be a better expression of what I mean. You know, and so it goes a little bit like this: is when you did this specific action, not a general action, but when you did this specific thing, not you always do this thing, but when you did this specific thing, I felt, right? And then the feeling that would come after would be, you know, I felt angry or sad or not. I felt belittled or I yeah. felt, you know, because, you know, now it's just making an accusation, right? And my need for connection, my need for whatever was not being met. And I have a request that moving forward, you do this, 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 and the other, right? And so one, it's very clinical, right? And so, you know, you get into a heated debate with your partner and you start using this clinical language and they're like, oh God, what's going on? Stop therapeuting me. But what I really discovered, and it took me about a decade to discover this, is that the process language is really just taking my judgments and squeezing them into a form that you think will be better consumed, but realistically, it's just a nicer book. It's like putting lipstick on a pig. The judgment is still there. And the real work is in understanding what are my judgments about that person and how am I projecting my judgments of you at you? Because whenever I'm projecting a judgment of you at you, the first thing that a human being is going to do is raise up their shield to protect themselves. And most often, our protective shield looks like, let me attack you. Let me tear you apart because I feel you tearing me apart.
Especially, Kelly, if the other person, and my husband has said this on my podcast, he wouldn't mind me saying this, especially with someone like my husband, who's one of his core wounds and stories he has danced with his whole life is, I'm not good enough. I never get it right. Mm-hmm. So because I would deliver it in what seemed like a rational, calm way, and I wouldn't say, you did this and you did, I would say, I wouldn't really use compassionate communication properly, right? But if I were doing better, I would say something like, okay, so I need to share something with you. When you did XYZ, you know, that felt really bad to me. I felt this way, but the way I was saying it, all of a sudden I would see the shield go up. I would see an energetic field, literally a shield go up, and I could see his face change and his body language. And I'd go, what are you doing? What is that? What are you doing? I'm not attacking you. I'm just sharing you. I'm telling you, I felt sad. I felt abandoned. That didn't feel good to me. It's my issue. But I want you to know that what you did triggered that. And that's why I was acting this way. But then we'd get in an argument because it would push that button of I'm not good enough. I get everything wrong. And then I would get offended and hurt and feel abandoned that he wasn't holding space for me. And it just became a bigger problem.
Yeah. The cheat sheet is, the word feel is one that has been twisted in our language to make everything a feeling that is not a feeling, it's a thought. And so the great thing about feelings is we can't argue with feelings. My feelings are always true. How I'm feeling is my truth. I can't argue with your truth. I can't argue with that. But we use all of these twists around the word feel that have nothing to do with feelings and everything to do with thoughts and thoughts that I am actually projecting at you. And so, you know, I always say the cheat sheet is if the word like comes after the word feel, it is not a feeling. That's the easiest one to think about. If I say, I feel like, whatever comes after that word like is not a feeling. It's a thought. And that thought is a judgment about who that person is. And, you know, one of the critical things in relationship, in relational dynamics, is that each of us will form some form of a negative image around my partner, right? They, you know, and it could be something as simple as, you know, they don't do the dishes. And I can work with that. They don't do the dishes, you know, but this person is a person who doesn't do the dishes. Translates to, over time, this is a person who doesn't care about cleanliness. This is a person who is slovenly, And over the time of the relationship, that becomes the lens through which I see this person. And because I've created this lens, now that is not just a thought or a story, it's a reality.
Oh, yeah.
And everything that they do goes forward to prove that that is the truth, right? So now it goes from a feeling of like, oh, you know, I really wish you would do the dishes sometimes, to you're a slob and you don't care about yourself, and everything that you do proves that. And so I then go say, you know, I feel like you don't really care about the quality of our home, right? And I'm sitting here going, oh, what do you mean? What are you talking about? You know, and vibrating inside. And so it's really about identifying, like, what are these images that I've crafted? And though, like you said earlier, you're like, I know this is me, this is mine, this is me working through this. What is it that I am really seeking to communicate to get what need met? And I think that's the really the critical piece, is understanding that every communication I'm making is an attempt to get a need met. If I'm speaking, I'm trying to get something from you. Not in a negative way, but literally, I want a smile. I want an acknowledgement. I want something. But most of us are not aware of what I'm seeking to get. So I enter into the conversation and the question is why am I saying this? What am I really wanting from you?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Most of us are really in our intimate relationships. I'm wanting connection, right? And so it comes down to what's effective and what's not effective. The compassion is really, how do I identify what my need is? What am I wanting from this person in this particular moment? And can I let all of the other judgments go in pursuit of getting the thing that I'm really wanting?
Yeah. Yes. That's so good. Do you really want that? Is that really what you want? Or do you want to be in conflict, and do you want to have this? Because sometimes I'll do that. You know, for example, if my husband is on his phone, on his laptop and his phone, on his laptop, on his phone, and has the television on. Mm-hmm. Sorry, TK. No, but if I'm wanting, for example, connection, I'm very verbose. I process through my speaking, and I will say, sometimes I'll go on and on and on. But what I'm wanting is connection with him. If I'm really honest, Kelly, instead of saying to him, if you were coaching me, you could say to me, let me ask you a question, Jill. When you got upset that you were talking, and while you were talking, he was scrolling his phone, and then he picked up his laptop. I'm just kind of processing right now. This is coming to me right now. If I really, really, really wanted connection more than I wanted conflict, you and I both know, if you offered me $1 million, I know exactly how to have connection with him. I could go over in a very loving way, and even I could even close his laptop on him if I did it in a really loving way and said, hey, I really want connection right now. Can we just talk for a minute? If you don't have time, it's fine, but tell me. It would go well. But instead, I think I'm getting my own answer is, I don't, in that moment, maybe I don't want connection as much as I want conflict, because instead of saying that, I'll say, never mind. Obviously your phone's more important to me, never than me. I'm never mind. I'm going to stop talking.
Yeah. But wouldn't it be possible to say that really what you want is the reassurance? And I think that many of us are carrying this story that if I have to ask for it, then you didn't really want to give it to me.
Yes. That's something I say often. I don't want to be invited to a party that I'm not invited to. I would honestly rather stay home. Don't invite me because you feel bad for me or that you think you should invite me. Invite me if you really want me there. And so it goes with conversation and connection, even with my own partner.
Yeah. And so in that moment, it's not just that you want connection, but you want to be wanted.
Yes.
Just him giving you the connection isn't really enough. You want him to desire the connection.
Thank you. Yes. I want him to want to hear my story and connect with me and have a conversation with me, even if the conversation is him just sitting there nodding his head. But yeah, that's so good. Thank you. That was amazing.
Yeah.
How do they find you on Instagram? No, that was really great, Kelly, because I mean, I'm trained to be a coach and I've been coached and I have done a lot of work, I feel, and I really didn't get that. I say that in the conversation with him around that topic. It's interesting you're saying that. I actually say things like, I want you to want to be in this conversation. You're right. That is what it is. I want to be wanted. I want him to want to be present with me, to hear me, et cetera. And yeah, that's really good.
Yeah. Yeah. And underneath that, there's my little girl. You know, if we go track that back at some point, that wanted to be chosen, wanted to be desired.
Oh, right? I was invisible as a child. Yeah. I mean, it was like I did not even exist in my home. That's for sure the case with me.
And you felt like you had to work for it to get it?
Oh, yeah. It's so funny. I remember, it's not funny. It's interesting that I shared this, I think, one time on the show that, so I had a violent, chaotic upbringing is how I would describe it. And my parents were constantly in conflict. It was either screaming and yelling, plates being thrown, a lot of things like that. Or my dad traveled Monday through Friday, 9 months out of the year. And it was just us with my mother, who had a lot of trauma, unresolved, lots of anger issues, et cetera. And when I remember riding in the car down the road, and I was in choir at school, and I'm not a singer. I can't sing very well, but I was so excited to sing to them this song that we were learning. And so back in the 70s, we didn't have seatbelts, you know? And so I came from the back seat to the front, right in the middle of mom and dad, and I was singing the song. And I was singing, and they just kept talking. And then my mom said to my dad, oh my gosh, poor thing. She doesn't realize she can't sing. And then I sat back down. And of all the memories of my childhood, that one is cemented in me. And so, yes, that is what comes up when I go in to tell a story to my husband. And I'm just wanting him to want to be there and wanting connection, and sometimes just wanting to share something with him. And I want him to want to hear the story or want to hear what I have to say. And when his phone's more important or he's half listening, it means something a lot bigger to me, I'm aware, right, than what's really happening.
And it's how vulnerable it would be to say, you know, listen, I desperately need to feel that desire. I need you to want to listen to me. And I realize it's not because of anything that you've done. It's because there's still this little girl inside of me that wants to be chosen. And I'm working on that. I'm doing my work every single day. Can you help me? Can you help me in these moments where I'm just wanting this connection? It's not about you. It's just, this is me. This is me vulnerably asking for you to give me connection. I guarantee he's going to look at you and be like, I got you.
Oh, for sure. You're right. And, you know, in defense of my husband, as I'm saying this, I do want to say what is obvious to you, that clearly we could flip it the opposite direction. And he could be on here saying, you know, there are times where he needs something from me and I'm not there. The reason I brought it up was the way you delivered the compassionate communication. I love that you said it's not just about the script. The way I am, my creativity, the way I think, the way I be, I can't stand that kind of structure. Even if it works, I would feel stifled. Like you could put me in front of on a stage in front of 10,000 people and hand me the most perfect PowerPoint created by Oprah. I will not be able to do it, right? But I'd rather just get up there and talk. So with that structure of the compassionate communication, it wasn't just the old term I didn't like, it was the structure of it. Mm-hmm. But I love that you said that a lot of us just compress our shit basically into that outline and then we go, I delivered it. I fucking delivered it.
And it didn't work, so why is he broken?
Yes, and I will tell you, I really do think that maybe intuitively I was picking up on that. Because what I have gotten really good about, and my husband's gotten really good about, is, you know, if I am hurt or upset about something, I couldn't do it before, Kelly. I wouldn't do it and I couldn't do it. But now I really can say, okay, Jill, what is this really about? What is it that you're really, really, really wanting right now? This isn't about that thing. What is it about? And I am able to go on my own give myself whatever that is and then have the conversation. Because in the moment when I'm hurting, that's like, for me, it's, I don't care what format you give me, it's probably not going to go very well with me. But that is something we've both been able to do. And many times, as you know, it goes back to the same old core wounds, abandonment, all of it.
Yeah. And, you know, in those moments when we're triggered, we're touching back to those hurts, those wounds. And, you know, I'm flooded with chemicals and my fight, flight, freeze and appease comes up, and my way of dealing with these anxious moments, they just start flowing out. So, you know, the key things that, you know, if I strip away all of the fancy language and the, you know, the pieces, the most important things I think are, one, identifying when I'm going into the conversation, what's my core need? What am I really wanting in this space? To go into the conversation with that is really helpful. And that's where having these other communities, having coaches and having people that I can talk through these challenges with. So I'm not trying to figure it out in the relationship, in the dynamic there, that I get a space where I can figure this stuff out, have somebody listen and reflect back what they're hearing, because I'm speaking my truth. I just need someone to listen through all of the other things that are being said and pull out the important pieces. And then show up in a relationship with the understanding of what's my core need that I'm trying to get met. And the other piece that I think is really critical, and you kind of touched on this a little bit, is reflective listening. You know, this is something that we do as coaches all the time, but if I can learn to do that in my relationship, to just slow the conversation down. And you know, I have this little game that I have clients play a lot of times, which is really simple. It just says, what I hear you saying is... And the game is, can I try to get it right? Can I get them to say, yes, that's what I'm saying? You know, what I hear you saying is you really want me to focus on you when you're talking. Is that correct? Yes. And you don't do the dishes. Okay. What I'm really hearing is you want me to focus on you and focus on the home as well. Is that correct? Yeah, that's correct. Okay. Is there anything else? Did I miss anything, right? The vast majority of conflicts that show up in relationship is really just one person or both people seeking to be heard and seen. Oh, you know, I share something and I just want you to hear it or see it. And then you try to do something about it, or you try to fix it, or you try to solve it, or you then tell me why you can't do it, or why you can't go this way, or why you shouldn't go that way, or you should go this way, or this is what's wrong with what you said, as opposed to just saying, okay, I think what I'm hearing is this. Is that right? And then just watch as the person just kind of melts when you just say the thing that they've been trying to say. And then they're in this space where they're like, I want to listen to what you have to say. And you're like, okay, now I can share what's alive for me. You know, and I'd say those are the two most critical pieces of having compassion for myself and my partner when I'm entering into these conversations.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. This has been so beautiful. So interesting. This conversation, we've gone in so many different directions. I don't even know what we'll call this.
I love these conversations.
Inside the brain of Kelly Gardner. Okay, so a man is listening. I do have male listeners, believe it or not. And I actually designed this for women, and I was surprised that men were listening. But a man's listening, or a female's listening, and she has a guy friend or a brother or whoever who she thinks, okay, they need this work. They'll want this work. I understand a lot of the work has to be done in person. And trust me, I get why it needs to be done in person. But you've got someone, let's say, in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and they're like, there's nothing like this. And I, right now, maybe I can figure out a way to fly next year to come to a group situation. Is there anything like this to at least start them online, where they can be in a community with men online? And then they know ahead of time, okay, if you can, we meet on these times. And if you can make it work, we're here for you.
Yeah, well, There are programs online. And I used to run a program with our friend Preston Smiles that was online, and that is merged to an in-person program now. But there are quite a few. And if someone wanted to reach out to me, I could direct you towards something like that.
Okay.
I am doing this is supposed to not be out in the public, but I'll share it with your listeners anyways, in case they happen to know some man. As I've shared with you, I have a men's group that exists virtually with some of the most amazing men that you may know. But what we all have in common is that we are all men who lead and hold big lives. And throughout our entire lives, we've always been the person that everyone looks to and never had anyone else to look to.
Mm.
And so I am running a men's group for the year, for 2024, for a very small group of men who have that experience. They have big missions on their heart. They're up to doing big things, but they don't have any place where they can just be themselves. They can be honest, they can be truthful, they can be seen, and they can be held by other men who are holding just as much as they are. So I do have a program that I'm doing in 2024 for men who lead. But if you reach out to me and that's not something that you are, you're just interested in getting started with men's work or personal development, I'm more than happy to engage. As you know, I'm happy to talk with people and get to know them and find out how I can direct them at something that might be suited to their challenge. And I work with men primarily one-on-one in relational work. I work a lot with men who are at transitions in relationships. My real passion is working with fathers. As a father myself, you know, it's something that when I'm working with a father, I'm not just working with one man, I'm working with generations. And I take that work very seriously, as well as with my partner, we work with couples as well. So there's a number of different ways that I can get involved. I'm not going to point anyone in one direction for a men's group. There's so many different ones out there. If you reach out to me and get a little bit more information about you, I could kind of point you in the right direction to find something. And there are ones in person literally in every state and almost every city in the country.
Oh my gosh.
And there are virtual programs that exist that I can direct people to as well, depending on who you are and what you're looking for.
Oh, I'm happy to hear that. I did not know that. That's good to know.
Yeah, I will tell you this one that's kind of the old school, the longest running, and I was a member of this, I have been a member of this program. It's called Mankind Project. They started in the early, I guess it was in the early 60s, and they call it the Mythopoetic Men's Movement, where you'll know the names of Robert Bly and things like that. And that group, it's a great place to get started for just about any guy walking off the street. He's never heard about men's work. They do a warrior weekend and get you an opportunity to kind of get connected with that. That's kind of the broadest one. And they exist in almost every town in America.
Wow. Okay. So
yeah.
Good.
So there's enough out there. And I'll say this about men's work. I never feel in competition with men who are putting out men's groups, because the need is so great,
yeah,
never be enough men to fill it. So mm-hmm. I'm more than happy to direct people to any place that they can get that need met.
Okay, so tell them your Instagram account. What is it? Your IG handle, as they say.
My IG handle. I am Kelly Gardner, KellyGardner. That's the best place to find me. You can find me on Facebook too, but I'm told that that's only where old people go. So,
so funny.
I feel like I'm old enough to be in Facebook.
You are. But I have like my Facebook life and my Instagram life. When I put something in my Instagram story and then it automatically loads to Facebook, sometimes like, oh shit, I have to go and like take it off. I'm like, I have like two different lives. Like Facebook is where I'm posting about my kids, you know, I'll show you whatever. Mm-hmm. But Instagram's where I'm really myself. But anyway, and you have great content on Instagram. Even if you are listening and you don't know that you or anyone you know will actually want to be a part of men's work or to join anything, find Kelly on Instagram, because he puts out some good shit. I'm telling you, your videos are great. And yeah, you're a great speaker and you have all of that. It makes it so much more palatable. But I love the way what you deliver. It's a great concept that needs and deserves to be shared. But the delivery, on one hand, true. You could have a podcast and sit in the middle of your kitchen eating spaghetti and talking to your phone. There's nothing wrong with that. If the content's good, it's good. People will listen. But when it's more palatable, it's just more palatable, right? And so your content's great and the way you deliver it is great because of your background, but also because you are very grounded and you're chill. It's really calming to the nervous system. Like, it's really calming as you speak and I watch your videos. I'm like, okay, you know, so I want you to know that it's like the delivery is great and the way it comes across, even when you're, you know, showing your personality, maybe you're talking a little faster, it's still very centered, grounded. It's good. It's really, really good. So I recommend people follow you even just to learn from you on Instagram. It's amazing how much you can learn on Instagram just watching people's videos.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I've shifted my ideology from thinking about it as marketing to thinking it more as a giveaway. Well, how can I give away as much as I possibly can? How much value can I potentially give to people so that, you know, my prayer, you know, before I come on this podcast, before I do any work, my prayer is that I be used in this lifetime to transmit what is not mine, but is for all of humanity to grow and to learn.
So beautiful. You're doing it.
Thank you, Jill. Thank you for the opportunity to be on this amazing podcast, to have this great conversation with you. This has been just so much fun.
Oh, thank you, Kelly. Kelly Gardner.